Hello and welcome to the ELT Chat podcast. I'm your host, James Taylor, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Chris Wilson. Hi, Chris. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, James. It's a pleasure to be here.
In this month's show, Sandy Millen speaks to new ELT Chat moderator, Hada Litton. Phil Longwell reflects on the beginnings and endings of lessons with some help from some ELT chatters.
And I spoke to some teachers about something that happens to us all at some point, a bad lesson.
So Chris, you've taken a look at a couple of recent chats. What was the first one about?
Well, the first one that was possibly the most controversial, most thought-generating topic of the last year, I would probably guess. And that, of course, was Saugata Mitra's keynote at IEL TEFL conference. And the discussion that came after that, there was a fairly good summary written of the chat with a load of links to all the bloggers who had who had written about it as well. And I mean, the list is just immense, how many people commented on it. And so I thought that was a really interesting topic to talk about. Did you attend that chat, James?
I did. And it was quite a chat, but it was surprisingly critical, I thought, actually. I expected there to be more people defending him, but generally there were quite a lot of fair criticisms, I think, in the chat. Were there any tweets in particular that stood out for you, Chris?
Well, Sean Wilden's tweet, which was a response, saying, "It's not about obsolescence. It's adapting and making use of whatever enhances learning. Good teachers have always done that." I thought that was a really good insight, and I think that's what I don't like about the sort of Mitra conclusion. It seems to be that he thinks this tech will make teaching useless. And it's always a comparison between classical teaching and, you know, this alternative, rather than using tech in a good way, which I think most of us teachers are trying to do.
Indeed, I know I am. But yes, no, and the second chat that caught your eye, what was that about?
That was about observations and good feedback, some good practices for feedback. I thought that's quite interesting because it touches a load of different types of teachers, your average teacher, your ADOS or DOS, who has to observe the person or the person being observed. And I thought, what's quite interesting for me personally about this topic of observations is I used to really, really enjoy observations, but since I've been having fewer observations, I now actually dread them a bit more. So I don't know if that's something that other people can relate to.
Yeah, but do you, in a more general sense, what's your feeling about observations and feedback, though? How valuable do you think they are?
Oh, I think they're incredibly valuable. They're a great chance to see, to get insight from someone else, be it a peer or someone more experienced. And when they go right, then, and that doesn't mean the lesson goes right, but when an observation is done right, then you'll gain something great from it. But that doesn't mean that I always look forward to having one.
Yeah, well, I think we can all understand that.
Okay, what thanks. About you, Jane?
For me, I love them, but that's because I've never had a bad one, maybe, but I've or bad experience. But I've only ever been observed once, and that was on video, so I was filmed. But then I actually got a copy of the recording and watched it later, and it was very illuminating. I found it very, very interesting. But yeah, it was a good lesson, so I was kind of lucky. But I would be very happy to be observed again. I think I'd learn a lot from it. So hopefully that will happen fairly soon. So thank you, Chris, for looking at those chats. And of course, there'll be plenty more interesting subjects for us to discuss on the next podcast in following ELT chats. So keep an eye on the website and make sure you vote for the chats that you'd like to discuss every Wednesday on ELT chat.
So I'm Sandy Millen, and I'm here with Hada Littim, who's one of the ELT chat moderators. Hi, Hada.
Hi, Sandy.
Can you start off by telling us something about you?
Well, I live in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia, well-guarded country, gorgeous, hot place where it's summer every day for the whole year. And I've been here for 12 years.
Okay, and where are you from originally?
Long story short, I was born in France and was raised there, and I moved to UK. I started going to London when I was about 14, and I moved there when I was 18 and spent about 20 odd years. So if you do the maths, then you know how old I am.
So what made you decide to become an English teacher then?
Well, I wasn't one. In the late 90s, up to the late 90s, I'd worked in the music industry in London for about 10 years. And then I became a Muslim. And it was kind of difficult to do both, the music industry and Islam. So RCA didn't see me show up, you know, with my hijab, my newly found funky hijab on. So I decided to teach. So I started teaching in an elementary school in London, and that was it. And I became a teacher. It was in 1997.
Okay, and where do you work now?
I work at the British Council.
So are you mostly teaching adults or children? What kind of students are you teaching?
Yeah, to be honest, I've been shying away from kids, from young learners, but I taught them for a long time. I taught the Cambridge CIE exams, IGCSE and A-level for a good 8 years. And I've been at the BC for 6 years, so adults for 6 years.
Okay, and how did you first come across ELT chat then?
I think it was through Marissa. So it was through Facebook, strangely enough. So yeah, through Facebook. I think when I started doing my Delta in 2010, and that was when ELT chat started off. And to be honest, I lurked for a really long time. I was just a lurker, just kind of going, not taking part. I mean, everything was moving too fast anyway. And Marissa, it's when I was looking for online deltas that Marissa came up, and the Celt Athens Center. And then I think I might have added one of her groups on my page, and that led to that, and I found ELT chat.
So you said that you lurked for a long time. What was it that finally made you join in?
I find it so intimidating to be around people like Marissa and Sean Wilden and James, and I always see myself as a newbie. I'm not really one in terms of teaching English, but I feel like one. So I think that I just needed to learn, and I just love listening and, you know, watching, listening at the same time. So I learned all that time, and it's only when I applied for that moderator job that I just had to start, you know, just start contributing and chatting with them.
And do you think there's a big difference to what you get out of the chats when you're contributing, where as opposed to when you're watching them?
Yes, kind of. I mean, I think it depends what you want from it, you know, what you're trying. I think contributing has helped me develop relationships with other tweeters. Rather than learning, I was learning anyway. But I think that by contributing, then people got to know me, and at least my name, you know, my handle. So then I got to develop friendships with people and know people a bit better. And now I'm kind of like on first name terms, you know, with some of them, and it's nice, you know. It's I think that's what I did. And my PLN suddenly grew, you know, exponentially. It's like huge. Uh-huh. So that's been great.
And what advice would you give to people who are joining ELT chat the first time, or maybe the first few times?
I think probably to lurk. It's just so, it moves so fast. And I only discovered tweet deck later. So I was trying to keep up, and I'd literally have two monitors on my desk and refreshing constantly, not realizing that you could just get tweet deck and it would just move by itself.
Tweet deck makes a huge
difference. It moves really fast, and it's quite difficult to sort of make sense of the conversation if you're not used to it. So it can be off-putting if you don't take time to understand how it works. So I'd probably just say to them, just kind of lurk for a couple of chats, and but if you have the guts and you're really comfortable with Twitter generally, mm-hmm. then go ahead and chat.
What do you think that you mentioned that ELT chat has helped to grow your professional learning network? What do you mm-hmm. think you get out of the online community that maybe is different from your offline teaching community?
Oh God, loads. I mean, first, you get a much wider range of teachers, from literally newbies to gurus. You know, you get to communicate and be in touch with people like book authors and material writers and bloggers. And to be honest, my colleagues aren't really into that. We work so hard where I work that we have very little time to do anything else, and I think that for me, my sons now, I have only one child, and he's 21, he's at uni, so I've got loads of time. I mean, not anymore, but I used to have quite a bit of time, and I love ELT, and after diving in with Delta, it opened so many doors that the PLN grew globally. Mm-hmm. You know, so going with ELT chat, and I think that's what I like about it. It's been great discovering people's blogs like yours, like Lizzie's, like Matthew's. Like I knew people like Thornbury and Luke Medding and Homer and all these people, but I didn't know the others, you know, and I think that their material is just as valuable to me.
Are there any areas of teaching which you find particularly interesting then, or the ones that you particularly like to do research into, for example, or experiment with?
Phonology and listening. I just love sound. I think it might have to do with my background. I just love teaching it. I love learning more about it. I kind of devise all these techniques in class, and usually my students love listening classes with me and speaking, you know, teaching pron and you know, intonation and conversation and all of that. I'm usually quite engaged in that, and I love that.
Okay. Thank you very much, Hada. That was fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you.
What follows is a series of questions about the beginnings and endings of lessons, which were first asked in a topic proposal by Matthew Noble and discussed on the 5th of March. The questions were used to frame the chat and also the summary, which was written by Sue and Anne and published the following day. The voices that you will hear, other than mine, are three teachers who contributed heavily to the discussion. They are, in order of appearance, Adam Beale, Kevin Stein, and Adi Rajan. First up, Adam Beale.
I'm currently teaching in Madrid, at International House Madrid. It's my second year there, and I've been teaching in Spain for about 4 years.
Kevin Stein.
I'm in Japan, and I live in Nara, which is the ancient capital of Japan. But I work in Osaka, downtown Osaka.
My name is Adi Rajan. I'm a business English trainer and course designer. I normally live in Bombay, and for the last 3.5 years, I've been working with the world's largest professional services firm, and I'm mostly doing business English and ESP. And before that, I was working with curriculum design. Throughout my career, I've mostly worked in training, business English, ESP, and related fields.
Okay, so first question I have from the chat is, well, the whole thing was about beginnings and endings, and the first question in the chat was, do you like to be in your classroom when your students arrive?
Yes, I try to be. It's not always possible, what with perhaps having consecutive classes. You know, sometimes they overrun. Or the other class is on another level, you have to run up a bunch of stairs with carrying books. But yes, I think sometimes it can be important to be there You know, it shows kind of a, I suppose, a sense of professionalism. You know, you're there before the student comes in, you welcome them, and you can kind of get the English rolling from the very beginning. So I think that's important. If it's possible, then yes, I'd say it's important to get in.
Kevin Stein.
First off, I just think it's, you know, kind of professional to be there as a teacher waiting for them. But, you know, I've also worked in language schools where there was barely any time to get back to the staff room, get your books, and dash off to the class. So I know it's not always possible. But if I have the time, I want to be there. I want to be waiting for them. Because just watching how they come into the classroom, you know, do they have their pencils out? Are they kind of lost as to where they should sit? It gives me a lot of clues. I can kind of read what's going to happen in the class just from that first moment. So even before a warm-up, I think it's really useful.
Adi Rajan.
Yes, I normally like to be in the classroom because I think it's a great opportunity to engage with students, to talk to them, to have a little bit of a chat. Because, well, firstly, if it's, you know, if you're just starting the course and you're getting to know your students, it's a great way to connect with them and build rapport. But secondly, even if it's, I think, midway during a course, you've known them for some time, but you always have weak or shy students who don't speak up in class. And I think it's a great way to connect with them as well. And they might really appreciate that time. And they see that you're coming in early. They'll also come in early to talk to you. And yeah. I think it's a good, it sets a good example to the students that you feel invested in the class enough that you're there. But having said that, I think practically it doesn't really happen. My last job, I would often teach back to back. So I'd be running between buildings, running between floors. So without a gap, maybe 5 minutes. So it's really tough to do that.
What do you do if students are late? Does that happen with your classes?
Yes. We had talked about this. It does happen a lot, especially with adult classes. So you have people who are working. And with everything that's happening in Spain at the moment, I mean, job takes is the most important thing. If they have to work extra time, then English is kind of pushed to one side. So when students come in and they're late, I do my best to kind of integrate them into the class, but slowly. I don't stop everything when they come in and make a big kind of song and dance about it. I let them sit down, they get their books out, I continue with the lesson. And when there's an appropriate time, when perhaps the other students are engaged in a task or something, then I would address that student, bring them up to date, and then bring them to the class.
There's really nothing I can do. The students are allowed to come into class and receive credit for class up to the final 20 minutes of class. So I got a 50-minute class. If a kid comes rolling into class 30 minutes late, that's fine. They receive full credit.
I used to penalize students for coming late by making them do a quick presentation or sing a song or do some English-related activity. But these days, I just incentivize the ones who come early, and I give them punctuality raffle tickets. Mm. If you want, I can send you one later. It's just a raffle ticket you put your name on. It says, thank you for being punctual. And then you, every time they come in on time, you give it to them, and then you put it into a little bag. And at the end of the month or the end of the course, you pull out raffles, and the people who come in more often on time get a prize, or more likely to get a prize.
And one of the questions in the chat said, how do you make your entrance each day?
Yes.
If I could just quickly remind you, I think you may have said something like, always enter with a smile, head up, shoulders back. Is that true?
Yes, I try to. It's important. Always kind of acknowledging that the students are there is important. Some teachers, I mean, that I've seen kind of come in, they shuffle about, they do stuff on the board, they move things up without really actually engaging with the students. So that smile is important, not always with the shoulders back and so on. It depends on your day, but a smile is good, and a hello and a how are you is always nice.
But I do try and get their attention somehow, right? I've juggled at the beginning of class, you know, I've pointed to a student and had them clap, and then pointed to a different student, have them clap and do clapping patterns. I mean, there's all kinds of, I worked for a long time with the young learners. So all those things that you would do with young learners to get their attention, maybe start by singing a song. I do that with my adult students as well, and with my teenage students as well. And it goes down like a storm. It's really fun, you know?
I'm not really, I mean, I'm normally there before the students, so I don't think there isn't really a trademark entrance that I can think of, no.
Right. Okay, well, another question. What does the start of your lesson look like?
The start of my lesson is normally a discussion, because I elicit as much information as possible.
Right.
So even if it's some kind of context setting activity, people are sharing in a structured way, either with each other in groups. And then we try to get feedback, whole class feedback as well. That's what normally happens at the beginning of sessions.
Okay, great. Okay, moving to the end of the lesson then. Have you got any techniques for wrapping up a lesson?
Adam Beale.
I don't really have any techniques. I'm very kind of aware of timing and giving myself enough time to make sure there's a logical conclusion to the lesson. But I always do a verbal summary. I remind the students of what they've done, what they've achieved, where we're going with the lesson, and more likely what's going to happen with the next lesson. And I think that's quite important, because it's just as important as the 10-minute warm-up at the beginning. It's a kind of like, we're coming to the end, okay, and this is what we've done.
Kevin Stein.
One thing I love to do is to just ask the students to pull out a piece of paper, and I will usually say, okay, what activity did you like the most? And give me two reasons why you liked it. And give me two reasons why, even though you liked it, you think it could be better. Mm-hmm. One of my other favorite things to do is to pick any activity from the lesson and to say to the students, give me two reasons why you did this activity. So if I do tabling, you know, I'm not going to spend a lot of time convincing them that tabling is really worthwhile. Usually I'll flip it around, and at the end of the lesson, I'll ask them why they think it's useful. Mm. And they'll provide all kinds of great responses for that. But the most important thing for me is, when I finish the lesson, is to just thank them and say, you know, it was a pleasure to teach you. And if I can give one or two concrete things that I thought they did well, and that I enjoyed, you know, in the collaborative process of learning, and then say, see you next time.
Adi Rajan.
Besides just the normal Q&A, I like to revisit vocabulary that we might have covered, incidental words that have just emerged in the lesson, or things that I've planned that I have on the board. I might go over that very quickly. I also like to go over the objective, and I think that's really important for business students, that you're able to say that this is what, you know, this is what we set out to achieve, and this is what we've done so far. I think they really appreciate that when you revisit the objective.
Okay.
And I find that, because I train a lot of IT and technology professionals, they really like a couple of minutes when you can share resources with them, which makes sense to them in their domain. So they love apps. So I like to tell them about a couple of apps that could be useful, which are connected to what I did in the session.
Mm.
So I think that's pretty good, like, you know, pronunciation app, or, I mean, there are hundreds that you can share with them, essentially.
Okay, and then finally then, are you the last one out of your classroom?
Yes, that's something I try to do. You know, I hang around, pretend I'm doing things and I'm not, but I do like to be the last out. I think that's important. If a teacher's kind of sums up and then goes, right, guys, see you, and then just leaves, I think it's not particularly professional. Mm. It's nice to hang around. Maybe they have some questions that they're not comfortable with asking in front of other students. So if you hang back, that gives them an opportunity to ask those questions.
No, I'm not. If I was the last person out of my classroom, culturally in Japan, it's very hard to end anything. People really love to spend a few extra minutes with each other. And there's always a sense of, who's going to leave first? Because I don't want to be the person who leaves the room first. You know, it's kind of uncomfortable. And if I don't leave the classroom, no one will leave the classroom. I mean, there could be 6 or 7 students stuck in there for an hour. So it's kind of my duty.
I'd like to be, but I'm normally not the last one because at least in the context that I taught before, I would teach 2 hour or 90 minute sessions, usually back to back. So I'd be running between classes and it was just, I have to tell people, I'm so sorry, I have to go another class and I'd run out.
Right.
So unfortunately that would happen.
On the 5th of February, ELT Chat held a discussion on how teachers feel after a bad lesson and how they transform failures into progress. A topic that was of interest to me and I'm sure is relevant for every teacher out there. After all, at some point we've all taught a bad lesson. As such, I asked the community to send in sound bites to put together and make a clip show for the podcast. I hope you enjoy it. Muranava of eflnotes.wordpress.com shared some of his insights.
Nowadays, I feel bad for not feeling bad after a bad lesson. Now that may sound flippant, but I think it does hold a kernel of truth. That is, for the most part, we really can't control what our students learn. Having said that, with experience, I think teachers can sense when something is going wrong and can put in measures to correct that. Thank you.
Matthew Noble, who tweets as Newbie Celta and blogs at newbieselta.wordpress.com, suggested the topic. So unsurprisingly, he had some interesting insights.
Okay, I'm going to try to talk for 2 minutes about, maybe three, about how I deal with bad lessons. So I think there are three main ways that I react to what I feel was a bad lesson, a disappointing lesson. Two are the extremes on either end of negative and positive, and one sort of a balanced middle way. The first one, the negative extreme, is to react to a bad lesson very badly. Get that sinking feeling, get that sort of depressed, blaming myself, and sort of a feeling that proliferates into a general self-doubt about, almost a dramatic self-doubt about my choice of career and how I'm a fraud as a teacher, and they're all going to, I know it now, but the secret's going to get out eventually, and how sad it is that I'm such a failure. So a bad lesson, if not processed or not dealt with, I think sometimes it becomes the seed of something really sort of desperately negative. That can kind of wash over you. Thankfully, it kind of does wash over me eventually, but it's sort of a dangerously, rough feeling. The other extreme is actually when a lesson could be just as sort of quote-unquote bad, but it actually just becomes a catalyst for change, and it's sort of a bad lesson is sort of obviously bad, and just creates a big shift in maybe, get me to see something that obviously you need to start doing or stop doing, or, help students change this behavior or change something in the room, whatever it might be. Something just becomes really blatantly obvious to me, and I almost have to say thank you, bad lesson, for, just making this so clear that I'm going to do this now. And so it's not even the product of a reflective process. It's just a bad lesson is almost like just a wake-up call to do something. It's like, bam, there it is. So in that way, a bad lesson is a good lesson. And then in the middle, sort of, I have a measured and balanced sort of a more rational way of dealing with the emotions of a bad lesson and the experience of a bad lesson by being reflective, processing what happened, being able to distinguish between what was the results of my actions, the results of other factors. Look at times that's happened before or times that that hasn't happened and look at cause and effect and be reflective about it and have a sort of productive process of looking at why it felt like a bad lesson, but why it's actually just, you know, just more data for feedback and reflection to enter into the machine of the continual process of developing as a teacher, becoming more sensitive to conditions and more sensitive to situations. And that's just, you know, a sense of just this is really what it's about. This is all I do. Either I'm engaged in this reflective process of being critical and engaged in looking at what happened, looking at experience and processing it, and, you know, acting through experience in the future in a smart way, or I'm not, and, you know, I want to be. So that middle ground is sort of, I think, the most common way. But the two extremes also happen, with surprisingly often, perhaps. Still after eight, nine years of teaching, sometimes I feel like I'm on a little bit of a roller coaster.
That's it for this month. Thanks to all our guests and to you for listening. If you'd like to know more about anyone on the show, have a look at the show notes, where you can find links to their blogs and Twitter pages.
For the latest news, don't forget to follow at ELTChat on Twitter or search for the hashtag ELTChat. You can also join our Facebook group by just searching for ELTChat. To keep up to date with our summaries and transcripts, go to eltchat.org, where you'll also find our back catalogue of podcasts. So from me, James Taylor, and from my co-host, Chris Wilson, we'll see you next time on the ELTChat podcast.
Goodbye.